Now you can say it. Now you can say something interesting.
Okay. Well, my slogan for our salon today is from Hunter S. Thompson: "When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro."
And so, I thought you were going there.
Yeah. It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Hey everybody,
potential title.
Access of Easy 22. Are we on 22? Recording this on September 17th, 2020, with Charles Hugh Smith, Jesse Hirsch, and myself. I'm Mark Jeftovic, and we will be putting this up on accessofeasy.com. And what do you guys want to talk about this week?
Well, go ahead, Jesse.
No, I was just smiling.
Oh, well, I would love to go back and revisit a topic that we've touched on in many salons, which is, what is the current version of capitalism that we're inhabiting and participating in, and how is it different from previous versions, or, quote, better versions that we imagine? And my little hook on that is, because I think it's a really fertile topic, because, you know, capitalism, the word, is used as propaganda, like, oh, well, you can't disagree with what we're doing because we're all capitalists. And so therefore, if we're winning and you're losing, it's just our meritocracy, you know, it's that kind of stuff. So that's why it's dangerous to use capitalism as a word, because it's got all these layers of propaganda and self-serving justification loaded on top of it. But the other topic I wanted to kind of introduce was Marx's idea, which was, of course, Hegelian, right? From Hegel's, you know, core philosophy, which is, history is not just a jumble. It's not a chaotic jumble of bad things and good things. It's actually on a trajectory, right? It's aiming for some better world, right? And so for Marx, that world that was going to be better was when capitalism reached a final, you know, crisis of its internal contradictions, finally unwound to where it could no longer sustain itself. And then we'd get some better world, which, you know, he called communism, and which, of course, has a negative connotation because that didn't play out so well in the real world. But let's talk about that teleology, which is part of the title of my new book, which is the idea, if you connect the dots of a system, you're going to get to a destination, whether that's the one you planned or that you like or don't like, it doesn't matter. You connect the dots in a certain way, that's the destination you're going to get to. So to me, that ties into this idea of, are we in late stage capitalism, like close to the final crisis? Or is that just we're just in another iteration of an endless, you know, version of capitalism?
I like Winston Churchill's definition of history better. One damn thing after another.
I think that was actually Toynbee.
Now that would make a lot of sense, but
I think he was actually saying that as a straw man, because he was then his next point was, it is not just one damn thing after another. But you know, it's easy to take both sides of that.
Right. Well, I've heard it attributed to Churchill.
Ah.
So.
And that's interesting, because, of course, he wrote huge volumes of history.
So. He did. Yes, he did.
And as we know on the internet, you can attribute anything to Einstein by default and pretty much get away with it. But not always credited, because you don't have to, but often on this podcast, I evoke Marshall McLuhan. Or more aptly, I rip off Marshall McLuhan and take something clever that he said, and I just say it, because in the culture of McLuhan, you don't actually need to credit the guy. But he was quite the Hegelian, and in fact, very much saw himself as one of the first people, and I think to his credit he was, to integrate media theory, to integrate technology, to integrate the contemporary drivers of capitalism as we've known it into the sort of Hegelian framework. But McLuhan was also devoutly anti-communist. Like, he was a Catholic convert who went to Catholic Mass each morning because he believed that the end of the world was nigh. And what he meant, and he was kind of accurate in this regard, was the death of the Western individual. He felt that electronic media, followed by digital media, would subsume the construct of the individual, the notion of the individual, into the collective, into the Borg, into the groupthink. And this made him paranoid. But because he was still engaged in a broader Hegelian exercise, and he meant it in the Christian sense of evolving to the Godhead, right? That the ultimate pursuit of the Hegelian, this is the, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, is that at some point you evolve to be worthy of a conversation of God. And so because McLuhan was so anti-Marxist, he didn't like the thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So he invented the tetrad, which was, instead of use three to describe this notion of Hegelian evolution, he had four. And I've mentioned it previously on this podcast, but again, did not give any credit. And the tetrad he often refers to as the rules of media, that each new media, each new technology, one could argue each new idea, brings with it four impacts: enhancement, obsolescence, retrieval, and reversal. That, you know, when the internet is invented, it enhances something, it obsolesces something else, it retrieves something, and it reverses something. And this was his way of describing what you evoked, Charles, as this kind of progression into the future, the way in which humanity, whether our thought, whether our technology, whether our science, or whether our economic systems, are evolving to become better, to be more efficient. And he really saw it as a media-centric process, that media is what makes our perception of reality, and that media and technology is what made the Industrial Revolution, what made capitalism as we know it. I say that as a sequitur, because the thing I've been thinking about this week is cults. And I've been thinking about cults, not just because we keep talking about things like influencers and elites and social media and narcissism, but because I've been watching the HBO show The Vow, which is a documentary about, forget the name of the cult, Nixium or something like that.
Oh, yeah, but I know that one.
Yeah, with Keith Raniere was like the cult leader, and he is in jail right now awaiting trial. And it's a fascinating documentary. And it goes back to how last week, you know, we talked about how our whole culture is propaganda. And that sort of led me to think, well, you know, our whole culture is kind of a cult. That it's like a multi-level marketing, open source cult franchise where anyone could join the cult of capital. And as long as you're part of the latest stage, surveillance capital, which is all about spying on people and marketing and data mining your customers and all that sort of stuff, then it's easy to be part of this cult. And it you know, again, building off the idea that our whole culture is propaganda, it struck me that the first four letters of culture is cult. And that maybe there's something to meditate on in terms of the cultish nature of the world that we currently live in.
When you started down that road on cults, for a second I thought you were about to say we should start one, but
that was my partner, when she and I were watching this show, that's all she would say. So all we were doing is, I gotta start a cult. I should have been running a cult. If this guy could be running this cult, making all this money, why can't I be? It's like, no.
I want somebody with some university level philosophy to take me and perhaps some people in the viewing audience through what exactly is meant by the Hegelian dialectical. I mean, we've heard that phrase a million times. I think I sort of know what it means, the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, but why is it significant, and why do people use it sometimes in almost a pejorative sense of like it's almost demonic? What does it mean? Yeah.
I mean, Charles, I can't address the last part, but do you want to offer your, and then I will offer mine?
Okay. I'll take a stab at it. And, well, it's called the dialectical, you know, analysis or a dialectical process, right? And it's supposed to be one of those universals, like you can more or less apply it to anything, right? And so, and it actually has roots in, as I understand it, now I'm not an expert in Greek philosophy, but as I understand it, it was considered as part of the rhetorical tools that everybody who was educated in Greece learned, the dialectical method. And so it's been around for a long time. And I think as far as I can say, from what little I know of Western thought, I think Hegel kind of brought it to the fore again, the foreground. It never really went away. I mean, there's actually Christian dialectics, right? And so it's a analytic technique. And once Hegel introduced it in the 19th century, then it was picked up by some of the existentialists. And so, for instance, Jean-Paul Sartre's last major work, the Critique de la Raison Dialectique, right? The critique of dialectical reason, where he tried to integrate Marxism and existentialism, essentially. So I think that's would be my kind of nutshell description of the dialectic methodology.
And I would build off that by saying that as a methodology, it's kind of, and I say this in my usual crass way, meant to justify the role of philosophers, right? It's meant to show the value that philosophy and philosophers have, because on the one hand, it is by definition critical thinking. You're taking an idea and then you're opposing that idea. And in the opposition to that idea, the argument is that you're going to get to a better idea in the synthesis, which then becomes a new thesis, which you should oppose. So the Marxists describe this in a very oppositional or a very revolutionary context where, you know, you're fighting the state, you're fighting the establishment. That's the thesis. You're the antithesis and you're trying to get everyone to the synthesis, very simply put, communism. But it's meant to be an iterative process in which you're doing it over and over and over. It's sort of moving logic forward, which, again, the philosopher uses to justify their bread, to justify their role, because they are advancing society. And one could argue this is what Silicon Valley does today in terms of constantly iterating and releasing a new version and going through as quickly as possible the kind of development cycle. But, you know, in the Christian sense, and certainly Hegel meant this while Marx didn't, it also evokes a religious context of evolving to God. That the process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis is that you're elevating your thought, you're reaching a higher plane, and the higher you get, the more likely you are to be worthy of the divine, to be worthy of a conversation with the divine, which, you know, I don't think no longer applies in a secular society, but it does speak to abstract thinking, that the more levels you can do this, the more abstract your ability, the greater your strengths as a philosopher, as a thinker, as a critical thinker. And so McLuhan, the same way that Charles was saying that you could apply the dialectical analysis to anything, McLuhan argued that you could apply his model, the tetradic analysis, to anything. And he, to his credit, I think he was coming from the world of ecosystems, coming from the world of environmental awareness, of realizing it's not a linear logic, it's a non-linear logic in terms of how networks work. And that was partly why he focused on the tetrad as applied to media and technology, because they are very dynamic, because they aren't linear in terms of their cause and effect, but are create ecosystems, create virtual environments in terms of the effects that they foster. Now, I'll bring this right back to the beginning and briefly ending. All of this is trying to anticipate what happens to capitalism next, or what happens to the future, or where is this pandemic heading, or what happens if more and more people opt out or revolt or reject established authorities, because that is the value of this method. That's why philosophers sort of are able to say, hey, this is why we have a role in society, because we'll help you prepare by anticipating what's coming next, because we're going to use this abstract thinking to anticipate the future.
And I would also like to briefly, if possible, it doesn't have to be brief, because it sort of brought us back to the word teleology, which is, are things just kind of happening unto, you know, just happening in succession, one thing after another, or is it creating this grand arc of history that's leading to a final, the next destination or final destination? And yes, Charles, you used it in the title of your book. So just briefly, it means, I mean, we did explain it a little bit, but I did have a mental note to just put some clarification around both those terms.
Yeah, thank you for that opportunity, Mark, because it's a word that doesn't, it's based on a Greek word, telos, which is the end. So it's kind of like the end of your whatever process or journey you're on is the teleology. And so it's kind of like a goal. It's kind of like the end state that the system outputs. And I'm, you know, but those are sort of abstractions. And so the way that I've kind of settled on describing it, it's like, you know, you kind of connect the dots of your life, of your experiences, of the era that you live in, or a system or a history, you know, whatever you're talking about, you can connect the dots in a way that there is a trajectory, like this leads to this, and this set of circumstances generates this output, and so on. And so, like in capitalism, just to use an example, what everybody senses about the current, I would call it state cartel surveillance capitalism, some kind of, you know, mouthful, because there's so many important parts we don't want to leave out. But it's like the system that we have generates inequality, unfairness, injustice, and basically gross distortions of incentives, and that there's no other output possible. And that's the teleology of the system. In other words, it's like you can have free will, but if you have systems that do X, Y, Z, these processes, you're gonna end up in a certain place, whether you like it or not. And so you wanna choose those dots you're gonna connect wisely. And I think that's to Jesse's point. We're talking about where is all this gonna lead? Well, you know, in my view, you understand the dots that you're connecting, then they're gonna take you to a place. And whether anybody doesn't like it or like it, sorry, it doesn't, the systems don't work with whatever you like or don't like. They're gonna proceed with the inputs, the processes, and you're gonna get an output. And the output is already revealing itself as social disorder, disruption, fragility, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
One of my favorite quotes of all time is Charlie Munger's, "Show me the incentives and I'll show you the outputs." And that's, I think, what right. we just talked about there.
Well, exactly. And there's a similar line from A Critical Pedagogy. You get what you test. That education right. isn't about learning. It's about reverse engineering the tests. Right. So whatever the tests are, that's what you get, rather than actually fostering some sense of education.
Remind me of the author of that, the critical pedagogy.
Sorry, and the phrase just came back. I truncated it. What you test is what you get.
Yeah.
And if you Google that, it'll come up with quite a bit of literature referencing it.
Who wrote that?
Albert
book?
Einstein. Just kidding. And I was being sarcastic.
That reminds me of Goodhart's Law, which is, once a measure becomes a target, it becomes useless as a measure.
Yeah. Which, again, if we're rolling on this, because I think this is relevant, it's the old, if you have a hammer, everything's a nail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And all this speaks to how our perception is shaped by the tools we use and the way we approach the world, which is why I felt McLuhan's Tetrad was so brilliant. Because media and technology does shape our experience of the world. And, right. you know, where he was very much a Hegelian thinker, he also was a footnote to Harold Innes. Like, he really elaborated on Harold Innes's work, who I mentioned previously here on the podcast. And Innes argued that with every new technology comes a new empire, that the old empire cannot adopt the new technology. It does not have the logic or the capability. So the opportunities for a new empire to arise as a result of that technology. And that's where I think surveillance capitalism is an interesting concept, because it, and I mean, Shoshana Zuboff, as an intellectual, is what I would call a nostalgic capitalist, in that she is very much, I mean, she's actually, Mark, I sometimes think you're a little bit of a nostalgic capitalist, but you're nostalgic not for a golden era of capitalism, but you envision a golden era of capitalism. So you are a futurist in that you're imagining a future world where capitalism works in the way you desire, versus Shoshana Zuboff is imagining a past world of capitalism that she thinks worked really well, that she wants to return to. And I think the concept of surveillance capitalism does rebut or defy the concept of late stage capitalism. Because surveillance capitalism is not late stage capitalism. It is not capitalism in crisis. It is capitalism reinvented. It is capitalism that has harnessed surveillance technology, that has harnessed digital platforms, that has taken the best aspects, and I don't mean best as in moral, I mean best as in efficient to the capitalist, the best aspects of monopoly capital, but without the trappings of monopoly capital, because, you know, it's a much different kind of monopoly capital. Let me compromise on that rather than get too deeply into it. And I think that's an interesting debate as to whether this is late stage capitalism, as many would argue, or whether capitalism has reinvented itself and the iteration has not led it towards the Marxist path of this is the end of capitalism, but instead has created a novel path, a completely new path, and that's where capitalism is headed.
I had, do you mind, Charles, if I jump in?
No, please do.
Yeah, I had one of those.
You've been shorted.
I had one of those I should have said moments after last week's edition when you were saying, when I said I can sum up capitalism in one sentence and you said, no, that's Marx capitalism, and how you were talking now about my ideal golden age of capitalism. And that's nothing I came up with. I mean, that's as old as Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich von Hayek and Rothbard. Yeah, I'm just channeling it, but I did by no means architected it. And I guess a future age would be, you know, future ideal golden era of capitalism to people like me would be Austrian economic based anarcho-capitalism, which will probably never happen in this universe, but we can always hope. But what we're talking about here, about this whole late stage capitalism, you know, as it's everyone is referring to it, and what it's referring into also ties directly into what we talk about a lot, which is the network state and what comes next after the nation state, because this is directly driving the next configuration of power. And I went out and I got that Innes book that you mentioned on that previous episode. It's Empire and something.
Empire and Communication.
Yes, that's the one. Haven't gotten that far into it yet. But, you know, surveillance capitalism does tie into our fears about, well, what if the network state is Google, is Facebook, and it's all just about surveillance and eventually social credit and...
Well, not eventually. That my argument is that exists presently.
True.
Yeah. Right? Like, you know, and that's where I think we... The Venn diagram that we share in terms of an overlap, I think it's that we are all cautious of these digital monopolies. But at the same time, I think we owe it to ourselves to be, while critical, attempt to be neutral as we assess them. And this is where, as much as I dislike them, I will argue, at least presently, that neither Amazon nor Google, and maybe even not even Facebook, who I despise, are authoritarian, right? They're centralized, they're powerful, they're monopolistic, but none of them actually promote authoritarianism outright, at least right now. I could see them doing that in the future, but let me say one other thing. I also think the Venn diagram where we all overlap is that I think we're all futurists. And that's where, you know, where I affectionately describe it as Marx capitalism, I'm not ascribing you authorship.
Mark with a K.
But I am suggesting that it's what you advocate. And that makes you a leader. That makes you a thinker, a philosopher, that you have these ideas that you've read, that you've absorbed, that you advocate. And so I think the Venn diagram that we all share is that we're all futurists, because each of us can imagine a future we desire, and each of us use our philosophical capabilities to try to map a course that at least gets us close, at least gets us going in that direction. That doesn't mean that we share those futures. We might have completely different futures, but the fact that we each employ the methodology of futurism is, I think, what we have in common and what we align ourselves, what we see as comrades in the sense. And that's where I think the extent to which surveillance capitalism, or the extent to which Google or Facebook or the network state is now our empire, is our regime, is worthy of exploration, is worthy of us dissecting and understand. Because if, as we hypothesize, that the nation state is now irrelevant, even if it is still kind of bloated and alive and kicking, because it has been transcended by the network state, which is the manifestation of digital empire, then I would argue, according to Hegelian logic, that there is something new emerging behind the network state, and we should be concerned about that as well, right? And maybe that is the decentralized democracy that we each desire. Maybe that is a new authoritarianism that we fear. But that's where I kind of feel we got to go back to the dialectic method, or the tetradic method, or futurism as a whole, and say there is no stasis, there is no stopping. If we're describing the network state today, let us also entertain what comes next, what comes tomorrow.
Charles, can I just throw one quick term
sure.
in? And then I agree with you that the Googles and the Facebooks and the big tech and Amazons are not authoritarian dictatorships, and they're not democracies
yes.
either by any stretch. I think what they are, and what they aspire to be, is a technocracy. They're technocrats, and that's not a dirty word to them. It's an ideal, and you have modern day, perhaps more mainstream, celebrated futurists like Parag Khanna and Jason Ponton and people like that who are writing these think pieces and promoting technocracy, management of society by experts, as the next step of democracy. And I don't see where, you know, you would need surveillance capitalism to make that happen.
Now, let me quickly just push back and say futurist is a synonym with philosopher.
Right.
So while philosophers are a great big bucket that include a diverse bunch of people, futurists are a great big bucket that include a diverse set of people, for the record. Because after I suggested we were futurists, I didn't want to be associated with the people you mentioned. So I just wanted to make sure that it's a very big bucket. Sorry, Charles, please, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna take a real stab here at trying to tie in things that you each have brought up. And I'm gonna start with Jesse's concept from McLuhan, that the individual, the Western concept of individual, has faded or been replaced by or absorbed, you know. And so that's a big deal. And I think that surveillance capitalism is definitely part of that empire. And it raises in my mind is the idea that the empire could strike back in two ways. One is, I've been reading like Thomas Merton, who's like, was a Christian sort of philosopher, a Catholic convert, much like McLuhan, I think, who delved into the Eastern religions toward the end of his life. And Kierkegaard, you know, the 19th century Danish philosopher who struggled with his own faith and with the existential things that really kind of launched a lot of what we think of as existentialism in common culture, which is like a sense of dread, a sense that God is dead, et cetera, et cetera. And in other words, your individual struggle in a chaotic world with no more solid foundations of faith that used to underlie, you know, conventional culture. So I could see pushback from the part of human nature that actually does want agency, that actually resists joining a cult. Because it seems to me there's parts of human nature that are completely satisfied and ecstatic to join a cult, because what Eric Fromm called the escape from freedom, right? And in other words, Nazism was a gigantic cult, and it was extremely successful because it basically hit all those human receptors at a very vulnerable point in German history. And so the cults work because they activate all these great receptors for belonging to something, for letting go of the dread and anxiety of having to, you know, choose your own life and be responsible and so on and so forth. But then there's another part of us that actually wants agency, right? So, and then, so there could be pushback against surveillance capitalism and that imperial, digital world from this human nature. But I also wonder if the nation state, and you could call it its dying kick, or you could call it its rebirth, we don't know yet, but there could be a nation state that decides to destroy, you know, private sector surveillance capitalism as a threat. Much like in the Roman history, you could look back and say the pagan religions struck back against Christianity. And there was a couple of emperors there that suppressed the Christians and reintroduced the pagan religions. And of course, they lost that grand battle, right? But I wonder if the nation state somewhere in the world might not strike back and attempt, you know, like one last ditch defense of its own unique monopoly, you know, on surveillance and power.
I was listening to a podcast the other day. I think it was Doug McKenty's. I was on his show a couple months ago, and the guy was talking about agorism. The person who coined the phrase agorism and invented it, I have the book right there, and I don't want to like jump out of frame to grab it so I can remember his name. I can't remember his name, but he did say there would be, he wrote this book, I think, back in the 70s, but he was talking a lot about what we talk about how the internal contradictions of nation states and the way they're operating and the imbalances of debt super cycles and stuff are going to tear them apart. But he said exactly what you were just talking about, Charles, that there will be, the empire will strike back. There will be this last gasp. And I think sometimes these things that the three of us talk about on this show that we worry about a lot in terms of increasing surveillance, not just capitalist surveillance, but state surveillance and social credit becoming more Orwellian and authoritarian. This could all be last gasp of nation state. And we know that centrally planned authoritarianism tends to not survive the long haul. But what I've been worrying about lately is a last gasp, the empire striking back for a moment in history could actually traverse longer than our and our children's lifespans. I mean, it could be a long time for the people who are caught in the middle of that last gasp, and it can make for a pretty rough couple of generations. I mean, we hear, you know, some of the work about long wave cycles, like the fourth turning crowd, and you know, it can take a whole 20 years to play out.
I could take 200, but I think both of you guys are using, you know, I feel like this is the same thing I said last week at around this time. I think you're both using 20th century analogies to try to understand something that is quite novel. And, you know, Charles, I think the spirit of your argument was 100% on, that the empire will strike back. And I think the nature of that return volley, or that return swing on the pendulum, is crucial. But I don't think it's the state taking over the monopoly. I think it could be the state trying to find a way to work with the monopoly. But I think the extent to which the state could operate anything credibly is gone, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Venezuela is the most recent example of this, but I think the you know, extent to which the innovations afforded by networks and the network state have created such a juxtaposition, such a contrast between what can be done by a nimble organization or a network of organizations compared to the vertically integrated bureaucracy of the state, which is so obsolete, it's ludicrous. And yet, because something's obsolete, that doesn't mean it goes away. You know, another McLuhan argument was that as soon as something becomes obsolete, it proliferates because it's no longer of value, so it is in abundance. Paper is a great example of this. Cable news is another great example of this. Totally obsolete and proliferating. There's so many new cable news channels. You know, you go on and on and on. But I think, Mark, to your point, it could be centuries in which these institutions and structures remain as the empire slowly crumbles. But yet, what is new about the network era that did not exist previously is the ability for different realities to coexist. For people to live in different realities, different empires, right? Virtually. So I think at least you and I, Mark, but arguably all three of us, we've been living in this new empire for quite a while. We've been engaging our professional lives. We've been thinking about ourselves politically and culturally and socially in networks, right? We're not necessarily tied to a physical geography. I mean, I'm sure Charles prefers to be in Hawaii. I'm sure, Mark, you know, there are lots of reasons why you're in West Toronto. And obviously, I'm very happy to be here in the Ottawa Valley. But any of us could be anywhere at any time and still operate our businesses, still function as professionals.
Well, my business
has already.
My business has no physical location. We have
exactly.
No office.
Right. We are already living in the new regime. And that's partly why I was saying, let us anticipate the one coming after that. And let's already start figuring out how we can set up shop there. But again, part of my argument is, I think those of us who pay attention, right? Another McLuhan line, nothing's inevitable provided you're willing to pay attention. That those of us who do pay attention, I think we're able to do just fine amidst these changing regimes. It's everyone else that we naturally have compassion for. It's the violence that these types of institutions result in because they're not able to adapt, because communities are left behind, because social infrastructure is left to degrade. So there is very real concern to be like, oh, we got to do something about this. But that's, again, tragically why I think it could be centuries in which the nation state persists, because the network state will exist anyway, and many of us will just migrate. We'll just go ahead and live in the new world while the old world languishes. And that's kind of my relationship to Canada right now. I don't know about you, Mark, but for the most part, I'm living on the internet. That's where my life is. That's where my priorities are. And that's why I do worry about Amazon and Google and Facebook and the power they have and how I, as a tiny little cockroach, am going to deal with these massive, you know, octopus. I don't know. Like, they're obviously huge creatures compared to me. But that, I think, is the larger question, and why decentralized societies, democracy, systems are so appealing to us residents of the network state.
I actually, at times, I feel a little bit of guilt about all this. And I know I'm not in any way meaning to overstate my role in history or anything. I'm another cockroach, too. But what happened with me and a whole bunch of other little cockroaches is we got on in the very early stages of the commercialization of the internet and started laying the groundwork for this. And I think by the time we realized we had created a monster, it was a little too late. Like, not that, I don't know if
I'm
articulating that properly, but.
I just think you were in the lab with Dr. Frankenstein.
Right.
So.
And
you
didn't notice it.
The monster.
Yeah.
You were just hanging out in the same spaces.
Interesting, interesting. And so I think you have survivor's guilt, Mark. That's what I think.
Well, cockroaches do, right? We can walk around.
A little
around
bit of Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah,
that's right. Well, and of course, if we're mentioning cockroaches, we have to mention Kafka. And I have often written columns where I combine Orwell and Kafka and Marx.
Yes.
Such a great cast of characters.
It is.
And Huxley, too, of course. Because you could pretty much to find that 20th century zeitgeist you're talking about, Jesse, by combining Marx, Kafka, Orwell, and Huxley. That covers quite a bit of ground. Well, I just want to throw in something that I've been wanting to write about more, which is the way that the real world economy is devolving. And we spoke about it last salon with the auto parts or the store or that Jesse had various experiences in. And of course, the fundamental basis of all, we're still in an industrial age. We call it post-industrial because we've gotten sloppy and lazy, and we've made these grandiose assumptions that there's always going to be lots of cheap energy. So if the energy gets expensive or there's not enough of it, then there's going to be some kind of catabolic collapse in the real world economy. Now, as long as there's enough power to run the internet, which it's not that big, a lot of people want to expand that and say, oh my God, it's going to be too expensive and it's going to suck the world dry of energy. I think it's around 5% of global electricity, but it could be as little as 3%. And if you cut back on the some of the parameters of that, you could cut it down further, you know. So I don't think that's going to be like we can't have the internet because we don't have any power. I don't think that's going to be the case. But it does mean that the real world is going to start impacting people's lives, even in the network state.
I mean, I can't obviously argue with the overall premise, but I will offer a personal anecdote to say it may not be as clear cut. I mean, where I live, the expectation that power will be cut is very high, right? And when power is cut, you have no sense of when it's going to return. And like, you know, because I'm on a well, without power, I have no water, right? And in the winter here, it's so cold that even though we got a fireplace, you know, you still want a little bit of electricity to prevent the place from shutting down. So I have totally re-engineered my emergency backup systems and my power outage plans to prioritize the internet, right? Insofar as I have electricity, that electricity goes to the internet. Then maybe the water. Then maybe some of the other appliances. And I don't think I'm alone in reorienting that kind of logic. That when I think of what I do in an emergency, I want the internet to know what kind of an emergency it is. I want the internet to let me plan how I'm going to deal with that emergency, right? And that's where we joke about how the internet was invented to survive a nuclear war. But I think the survivalist tendencies that, especially this pandemic, is nurturing in many people, is improving their internet literacy and is prioritizing how they use the internet in their lives. So I agree that, you know, to your subtext, climate volatility and the impending climate crisis is going to rock the foundation of the industrial global economy as we know it. But I think the internet is going to be valued above and beyond most things as and when that happens. And even though this may require sacrifices and changes in terms of how people live, again, I kind of think the internet's going to be remain the fabric by which the network society, the network state, and the networked individual continue to live their lives.
Mark, take it away.
Well, you're reminding me of a science fiction plot line that I've been pitching to my wife, who writes romance mystery novels, that, you know, a near future scenario where everyone just kind of lives in like little pods plugged into the grid, and they get their nutrients piped in, and they live in like a holodeck so they can live whatever kind of life they want inside this virtual reality. But the elites of society get to live in the real world. They get to fly on a real Learjet and eat real steak, but while the people in the pods, hang on, I gotta tell you the plot line though, because all romance stories are the same. It's like the people from the two different classes of society, right?
So I anticipated
one of the pod people falls in love with one of the real life people, and then you know, love against all odds. And then at the end, the twist, the person you thought was the real person is in the pod, and the pod person is the real person, and roll the credits.
Actually, the ending I do find quite original. That's That's, I mean, obviously it's the same trope, but a very original application. But I just want to point out the thing I always point out of this podcast. You just described the pandemic reality as we know it, right? All the people living in condos, having the food delivered to their door, having their groceries delivered to their door, spending their day watching TikTok, while the elite actually get to go to their cottages, actually get to travel out of the country to places where there aren't lockdowns. In fact, there was a story this week in Canada that a U.S. billionaire was allowed into Canada for 36 hours and not subject to quarantine because they're a millionaire.
I saw that. That was the Uline person. And it was weird because I got a Uline catalog in my P.O. box today, and I was talking with Mohammed, the guy who runs the P.O. box. I'm like, he's like, yeah, I had 20 of these, had to put those into your mailboxes, and every single one of you just threw it in the recycling bin. And I'm like, it must cost them billions to send these bricks out. This company must be going bankrupt. And then the next thing I saw, the 1236 article, and it's like, really? She flew here on a private jet and bypassed
anyway,
the...
Anyway, to your point, your story is coming true right now. It's just not as evil. But the cultural side is there. Most people are holed up in condos, can't go into the real world. And yet on Instagram, they see all the wealthy and elite and the influencers living it out in the quote unquote real world.
Well, when I get especially paranoid, when I'm having like those apocalyptic paranoia episodes, I believe that this is all part of the plan to herd most of society into accepting that kind of reality within two or three generations.
Versus, I think they've already accepted that reality.
Okay, well, let me interject another science fiction plot. I believe it's from the late 50s or early 60s. And it was in the era where Frederick Pohl was writing. And it was a story. And I'm sorry,
he's
I don't remember.
Hold on, I guess he just died. Sorry, go ahead. Oh, did sorry to interrupt.
Who was that, sorry?
Fred Pohl.
Okay.
Yeah, famous science fiction author of the early days, you know. Anyways, I don't know if he was the author, but it was in that era where everybody's living in this nice little world. And what they don't seem to realize is, you know, when the brick wall is about to fall on them, some creature goes in and protects them, saves them at the last second. And then they're about to stumble over something that the creature arises, and I believe it might have been pets. It might have been the household pets were actually super naturally powered beings who saved us at every little thing. And I think that's the that's industrial society in a way. Like Jesse, when you start describing the nuts and bolts of actually trying to compensate, even temporarily, for industrial society, are just horrendous. You know, and I was just talking to Chris Martinson in a podcast, and he's got sort of like you, Jesse, he's got a large homestead, and he's gathering a lot of people to do a lot of work and have a community in eastern U.S. And he's saying he's got a bunch of people from New York, and not to bang on anybody from New York, but his experience is people don't know how to do anything. They don't know. They've never picked a single item of food from the earth, from a vine. They don't know what sheetrock or drywall is. I mean, they literally know nothing about the real world because industrial society has been so effective at basically, saving us from every little impact. Right?
I'm one of those people. Like, I'm hopeless. Hopeless. Go on.
So, if industrial society phrase, which I believe is not going to take 200 years, I think it's more like in the next five, we're going to see like shortages of energy that are going to bring John Michael Greer's catabolic collapse to happen. In other words, there's going to be like the energy state is going to collapse off of a cliff and find some footing at a much lower level of complexity and energy consumption. And so the question is, kind of like atoms, you know, in a covalent system, what happens when the energy level drops? How severe is that? And so then part of what I think the futurist mentality should be, well, let's kind of think like, well, what are those parameters of those energy drops and complexity drops, right? And so it can be not so bad, right? Like you don't get your trash in the city picked up twice a week, it's only once a week now, or twice a month, you know. But it could also be like your trash never gets picked up. Because guess what? That service is gone. We don't have the money. The crews have abandoned that. They no longer want to do the thing for the pay that we can offer them, et cetera, et cetera. The trucks are broken down because of the parts are no longer available in the supply system. There's lots of these things. And I think the more you know about any one part of the industrial supply chain and the complexity that it's built into it, you get more paranoid, Mark, because like I've had readers tell me, they're in the delivery of gasoline, of petrol system, and they're saying, you know, hey, 3 days, it's gone. The whole thing could easily break down, and then there's none left, period. There's none left in the supply chain, not just in your local petrol station. There's none in the supply chain. And so, and then the same is true of food, and the same is true of lots of stuff. And so when that collapse happens, I don't think we're going to get 20 years. And I think that once that disruption happens, then we're going to be exposed to all the fragility in the social and political systems.
That's what I was very concerned about in January when this whole thing, coronavirus, started breaking. I was very concerned about supply chain breakdown and started stocking up, doing that kind of thing. Jesse, I think you were as well. Now, what the problem could be is because we had what was supposed to look like an existential crisis in March, got turned into government stimulus in May, and then turned into all-time stock market highs in August, and people now think, oh, so this is how we deal with existential crises now. The government's just going to write a bunch of checks, the stock market's going to go up, and everything's going to be fine. And the next time when there's a real existential crisis and what Charles is talking about actually comes to pass, it just reminds me, I'll stop after this, Jesse. I remember a New Year's Day. I might have told this story already on this podcast. I can't remember. I was like 30 years ago, New Year's Day, all the restaurants are closed. We're walking down College Street in Toronto, just kind of talking, and there are these young hipsters going door to door looking for breakfast, and all the restaurants were closed, and they're kind of like shaking at the door and it's locked, and they're just kind of like, this is the modern day equivalent of foraging for food, but they couldn't find any, and we just went back to the apartment and fried up some eggs and bacon because we were old fogies and we knew the old antiquated skills of how to actually make your own breakfast in your own apartment. But that, you know, imagine that to the unlimited degree of just everybody saying, well, where am I going to get my food from? If I press the button on my smartphone and my food doesn't show up, how am I going to live?
I mean, I think you're both being a little alarmist, although I do agree with the general sentiment expressed by both of you. You know, hopefully, if you think of the Russian revolutions as a template, since we evoked them last episode or the one before, you know, the Spring Revolution was a warning, right? That's when the sort of provisional parliament came to power and the Tsar was overthrown, and there was a brief thought of, oh, we're going to have a liberal democracy. Of course, until the October Revolution happened, which technically was in early November, and the Bolsheviks took power and the Russian Civil War happened. I kind of feel we're in a similar timeline right now.
Sent shivers down my spine, actually, when you were presenting.
Well, because it matches our political timeline, right? The spring pandemic was a warning. Man. And we are now headed, whether you look at the Spanish flu or you look at some of the modeling that has been done for this particular pandemic, the fall and the winter is when things are going to go nuts. I suspect the death rate will be a lot lower because medical organizations have had time to find treatments and therapies and strategies. But we're already seeing a huge uptick in infections, schools gone back in, and of course, the U.S. presidential election provides the political chaos of the
world. I think that's the catalyzing event. It may not even be the coronavirus. It could be the election.
No. I disagree. They're in tandem. They are inseparable. right? The coronavirus is global. The presidential election is American, even if it has global impact. But that's not my point. Allow me to get to where I'm going with this. While I agree that all the framework's in place for the S to hit the fan, I actually think there's a lot of resilience out there. And I, again, cite my own personal example that the things I know how to do now that I did not know how to do 2 years ago, that I did not know how to do 5 years ago, are incredible, right? I can bake the best bread you'll ever have. I got chickens making eggs. I got goats making milk. The extent to which my self-reliance, I'm just in the middle of sweeping my chimney right now. That's why I was a little late for the start of our podcast. So as soon as I'm going to go back to sweeping my chimney. You know, I repaired my hot water tank. I maintain and repair all of my vehicles. This is all stuff that, like yourself, Mark, I did not think I could do when I lived in the city. And I don't think I'm alone. But I think that there is a growing number of people who, empowered by YouTube, are doing everything themselves, are becoming more and more self-reliant. Hopefully, we're not going to get some October surprise that, you know, makes it impossible for everyone else to jump on the homesteading or the DIY or the open source bandwagon. But this is why I'm a little cautious optimistic that the catastrophe you guys are convinced is coming will not play out as badly as we might think because of the resilience of the human individual and the human being and the human community and the internet and the extent to which the internet provides knowledge on demand and how, speaking from first experience, there's a ton of knowledge for self-sufficiency on anything you could imagine that enables a wonderful decentralized society. If only people had the reason to look it up.
I'll just, the last thing I'll say, I think you are atypical, and you may be part of a rising wave, but I still think that wave is extremely small. But hang on, to your point.
I got to rebut. No, hold on. Okay. I've got to quickly rebut because, you know, when the going gets weird, the weird turned pro. So, yes, I'm a weirdo, yeah, but I'm at the head of the pack.
When the going gets...
And I agree that I am pretty far ahead of the curve, but behind me I see a tsunami. And I think that that is where everyone is coming because they're scared of the scenario you guys are describing. And they're going, I don't want to get caught holding the bag when that storm comes. So I'm going that direction, and that direction is self-sufficiency.
When the going gets weird, the weird go to YouTube. But the other thing, Charles, I think you know him
as
well.
That's the title right there. Sorry, okay. Go
ahead. Dmitry Orlov, I'm friends with him on Facebook. I think you might be as well. His first book was Reinventing Collapse. What I liked about that book was he talked about the collapse of the Soviet Union and why that society was counterintuitively fairly well prepared to weather the storm of the disruption that political collapse caused. And then he talks about why Western society, like the United States, is not, and it's more brittle. Now, granted, he wrote that book, I don't know what year he wrote that book, but it was before, I think it was like the internet was becoming big, but it wasn't ubiquitous yet. So that, to your point, that could be possible. However, even though globally there could be energy supplies the way Charles is talking about, I could picture in a collapse situation the grid going down and you can't get YouTube. So whoever doesn't have the foresight to obtain that knowledge before this happens, see, I think that's the key. You have to obtain that knowledge before this happens. You can't be Googling how do I bang two rocks together after it happens and you've got no power and no rocks.
Okay, for my final comment, I just want to say that I often refer to YouTube University because that's really the university model that I think, and then what I saw and wrote about in 2012. So that's very real and very powerful, and we all use it all the time. I think I want to go back real quickly to mention that I don't think collapse is like from 0 to 100. I think it's like John Michael Greer's concept of catabolic. It it's much more likely that there would be a reduction in complexity of what's affordable or doable. And so then, like I said, you know, your trash gets picked up, you know, twice a month instead of twice a week or something like that. And maybe food runs out more often in the grocery store, but it's not like a complete, you know, zombie collapse, but it's a reduction to what's affordable in terms of energy consumption and management, right? And so how many steps there will be and how many spaces there is between it, we don't know. So, but I to this whole point of like how many people are doing it, I think we can go to the Pareto principle. You know, when 4%, the vital 4% are moving, you know, coherently, they're going to influence the 64%, and that's the 80-20 rule reduced. 20% of 20% and 80% of 80% gets you 4% and 64%. I'm kind of with Mark. I don't see any evidence that we're getting close to the 4%, but maybe we are. And the closer we get to the 4% vital moving coherently, then they're going to have this outsized influence on the 64%. And then we're going to really see a cultural movement. But I'm in favor of the salon cult, by the way. It can be digital, but it needs a home base that's very attractive. So, you know, let's just say Canada.
See, this is where, again, you guys are bringing up my Groucho Marxism, that I can't join any club that would have me.
Would you join a club where all the recruits gave you all their wealth?
No. No, because eventually they're going to want it back. This is where I cite the great poet Bobby Dylan and the Drifter's Escape. Or another one, Ramblin' Gamblin' Willie. That once you win all the cards and win all the pot, get out of town. And you can't with a cult because they're all around you all the time. Yeah, I would never want to have a cult. It's terrible.
And I'll end with this. If I won any election, I'd follow that dictum of when asked, what would I do? My first action in office would be demand a recount.
I've always said
that I would be resigning if I actually won the recount.
I've always said
it reminds me of Richard Pryor's Brewster's Millions and the vote for none of the above campaign.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mark.
I was only going to tack on John Michael Greer, his term for the slow catabolic collapse was The Long Descent. That was his first book, and maybe not his first book, but he applied it to the Roman Empire. It took about 300 years, I guess, from beginning to the end, and described it quite well in there. And I think we can stop it there. So like us on YouTube, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple iTunes.
And don't forget to insult us in the comments.
Don't forget to insult us in the comments. Actually, the comments were pretty good last week. So, and send your friends to accessofeasy.com, and we will see you all next week.